Let's talk about giving for just a minute. I want to just touch on this real briefly. Giving is an important part of our handling of our money, that God tells us to give. You've got these things in your notes, but let me just run down kind of a brief list of what are some of the principles. I'm not going to try this morning to convince you whether or not you ought to give 10% or not. I'm going to try to convince you that 100% of it is owned by God, and how much of it He allows you to have back. That's what's really important to us, not whether you give 10%. First of all, first principle up here comes out of Proverbs 3:9-10. Give the first of your income. Give the first of your income. I've heard people comment on this a lot. I think the first of your income is the first of your income. That means that income given to God's work comes before the income taxes and not after the income taxes. Giving to the government is your way of supporting the government, but giving to God needs to come off the top and not off second or third tier there. Give God first. Second, give regularly. 1 Corinthians 16:2 tells us to set it aside and give it to God regularly, first of the week. Give voluntarily and cheerfully. God is more concerned about our attitudes. In fact, the Bible tells us in the Old Testament that the purpose of giving is to always put God first in our life. So God is concerned about the motive, and give generously. Another principle is to give secretly, not to let your left hand know what the right hand is doing, not to be boastful about it, and then give sacrificially. Our concepts of giving that we need to apply in our life not only involves money, what we're talking about here, and it involves use of your things. Do you give the things that you own to God's work? I know John Crawford is a fellow that loans out his truck to me from time to time. I appreciate it. We've reciprocated that over the years. Giving what you have, giving what you own, those are principles of giving. Giving off the top. Let's talk about saving. Debt's really just negative saving. That's all debt is. It's just giving it away before you ever get it, having to go on. The Bible says that debt's slavery. This is a definition that Kirk Humphreys came up with. I like it. Definition of debt, it says, owing for items which cannot easily be liquidated for more than the amount owed on them. Certainly that involves credit cards, because those are typically consumer goods that credit cards buy, or their services. In case of services, you can't liquidate them, they've already been used. Houses, I don't think, fall into it. At least my own personal conviction is homes don't fall into the definition here. Typically, homes appreciate, and except in Oklahoma, where we've had about a 20% decrease in value. My folks who live in Carlsbad, California, bought a house for $37,000 in 1968. It's on the market now for over $300,000. They have made a very good investment. My investment is questionable.
Hang on.
Hopefully over time. Land is an irreplaceable resource. It doesn't disintegrate. It stays there. People are going to use it in the future. It's going to have value. The population's going up. It's not going down. So just the rule of reason is that real estate will appreciate. Yes?
The only way your parents can really achieve that gain is to sell a house there and move somewhere else.
That's right.
Because the replacement value
is going to
be what they get.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. They could buy quite a house in Oklahoma for $300,000.
There is a state book that was printed in the 70s called The Coming Real Estate Crash. And in it, the author tied real estate values to the how well the A&P and the other stock markets were doing, and came up with a formula by which to track real estate values, because although the story language has said they ain't making any more land, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to sell it for what you paid for it. It's all due to the demand in the market. And he gave some good solid guidelines about how to track and see which way the economy is going, so that when you do make an investment, you make it wisely and not wind up in a crap spending $100,000 for a $50,000 house.
Yeah, there are some principles we could talk about on that. That's a good point. Obviously, most of us have heard that location is the secret to buying real estate. There's just a wealth of evidence to support that. But that isn't the only principle either.
Time is a variable that you have to look at.
Land in these days, this particular economic climate is very poor investment. Having cash is and being liquid is a very lucrative investment right now. It may change next year. Who knows? Let's talk about debt for a moment. Debt being negative savings, reasons not to get in debt. I'd like you to tell me, what are some reasons to not get in debt from your own opinion? What are some reasons not to get in debt? Yeah, John?
Lose peace of mind.
Can I put down worry, too?
From a practical reason, it costs more to buy it on credit than it does to buy it in cash.
Okay. The cost? It's expensive. Yeah, we're going to look at that in a minute. It's very expensive.
It's predicting the future.
Okay.
None of us can predict what tomorrow is going to bring, so you're really depending on
future events. Future events, and we could call that presumption. There are people in Oklahoma that in 1983 would have never imagined that they would have, that they'd be out of work. They wouldn't have a job in the oil boom, and their future, at least the near future, came to a screeching halt when those oil jobs let go. Then the banks, the real estate. So debt is presumptive spending. It's presuming God's going to supply in the future, and presumption is sin. Okay, we don't have control over future events. What else?
Blocks God's ability to give.
Okay, blocks God's blessing.
Our dependence on Him.
Okay.
Our dependence. Credit instead of dependence. God,
yeah. Yeah. We know we can get it. Good. What?
You want to explain that?
Blocks God's blessing? Ralph brought it up. Ralph, why don't you explain it?
Yes, a lot of times, by short circuiting what God may have something else in store for you, by going out on your own and buying something, you may have been at some point in time somebody had that to give to you, or it could have been or a blessing not to have the first step place for your children. I know in our home, we have a 3-bedroom home. I have 4 kids. I have 3 little boys in one room, and 1 little girl in one room, and then my wife and I. We live in about just 1,395 square foot home. Well, we have found it a real blessing to be in that home and not to go out and get debt on a bigger home. We can afford a bigger home, but my job situation doesn't really allow me to just haul off and buy a big house. But the result of that, as far as blessing, is we have a very close knit family, love each other, who know how to say, will you forgive me? I'm sorry, and ask each other for forgiveness. And, I'm just proud of the kids. That'd be one example of how I think that God is blessed in light of maybe having some goodies.
I'll give you, Tom, an example out of my own life. My wife and I, Cherry, made the decision 10 years ago not to buy a car on credit. So we drove a little Ford pickup for about a year. Until the Lord provided something else, and really struggled with the whole idea about not buying a car on credit, because I looked at my contemporaries and they're all driving these cars, and I am driving a 69 clunker, but committed to the idea that God will provide. Well, we've done this until this year, and then God opened up an opportunity and the company decided to give me a car. Now, I don't know why they did that, but they're paying for the gas, they're paying for the car, and they're now paying for the insurance. So I trusted God and He provided a blessing. I can't predict that what happened to everybody, but it is an evidence to me in my own personal convictions that God will bless.
About a year ago, my wife and I were praying for a second car, and we had a nice Honda Civic, pretty good car, and I'm not here trying to plug four cars, it just is a good car. We needed a second car because of taking the children to school or babysitting, just one or two days a week for that. And for me, we prayed. Well, we had credit for probably about 3 or 4 months. And we knew that God would provide. We trusted Him to provide. Even though we were trying to figure out ways, you know, how you always try to rationalize in the flesh how you can do things. Well, I'm glad we did, because in March of last year, this guy knocked on the door, a Christian brother, and he said, how you doing? Fine. How are you doing? It was a Sunday afternoon. And we got a car for you. I dropped the tea. It was a free car to us, and he picks it up, got one or two new tires, picked up the radiator, picked up this, picked up that. It's a 77 Chevy Nova, and it runs fine. Free. Now I'm having faith in gas and insurance now. We've already paid for the first car on the green.
Yeah.
That was a great lesson.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That's a good example. John?
A couple of years ago, I bought the car on time. It was the first time I'd made car payments at 64. And I did it without consulting God, and it's been miserable in car since, you know. And I still owe, I guess, maybe $7,000 on the car. Do you think you're better off just going ahead and selling the car? And, you know, because you're going to have so many expenses on an older car anyway. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I have driven an old car up to now. I mean, the car I've got now was given to me by the company. It's the newest car I've ever had. And I've heard people say, you know, that the payments on a new car is far less than the expenses on keeping up an old car. I think that those people are absolutely uninformed. There may be some isolated cases when you have a lemon, but those are the isolated cases. They are not the rule. It is much cheaper to repair an older car and keeping it going. You don't have to have everything repaired on it. We've had dents all over this thing. The radio didn't work. One of the hinges on the back didn't work. We have a choice of what we choose to repair and what we don't. One of the problems is the mentality that I've got to keep up the image that people expect me to have. And the car is a sign of that. And you really, if you can get before the Lord, and I'm not saying you, John, I'm just speaking generally, and turn that back over to the Lord, we don't have to have that image because people like us without it.
Just practically speaking, Consumer Reports did about a 5-page article on cars, and it is never, ever, even with a lemon, cost effective to buy them.
Yeah. Just stay away from Jeeps. Consumer Reports rates them horrible.
2 Corinthians 9:8 says that God's able to provide for us whatever resources we need for good works. And so if we have to buy or borrow, rather, to do something, we may have owed something God doesn't want to save.
Yeah. I did buy that car, and I decided I was going to sell it. If I had to take a loss, I was going to sell it. because I was that deeply convinced that owning, I knew the minute I walked up to the dealer and signed the paper, the thoughts in my mind was, are you crazy? This is against God's law. And I signed that piece of paper. I knew right then I was in trouble. Again,
when did you do this?
1981, I bought it and then turned around in about a month and sold it, 2 months. God provided, even in that case, that somebody was willing to buy it for just a little more than I owed on the note. And I lost a little money on it, but I walked away with a load lifted. A load lifted. Yes, Steve?
I think number five up there might be what you were just alluding to, and that is that you take away a means of God's directing you, His will. Because when we use debt to satisfy our needs,
I've heard that men really care most about, I think it's probably true, because at least it's true to me, cars, kitties, and cash. All of us have to deal with the male personality, and our car is a reflection of our ego, kind of an alter ego for us. And you do take that to your feeling of self-esteem when you drive something, and that's a piece of junk. But it is an opportunity to get our esteem needs melt and die. It's simply a reflection of ego.
You don't have much to budget with, because the choices have already been made to pay off your bills. 10 years ago, I bought a Honda Accord, and I had no car payments for 10 years. Those of you who are making car payments, if you could imagine not having to do that for a 10-year period, what you could have done with that money. I've owned two homes right now. I'm renting, and really for me, renting is a far less expensive way for me in my situation to live. It also gives me the flexibility, because I'm in the Air Force, flexibility to heat air power, I would say. it allows me to really be able to leave. I came to Enid expecting to be there 3 years. Renting has not only been far cheaper, but it's really increased my flexibility. It's been cheaper after taxes. Some people say, why are you getting killed on taxes? And again, they haven't taken the time to really sit down and count the cost of owning versus renting. And I'm miles ahead by renting.
Yeah.
So just get your paper out, your calculator, and go to work.
Yeah. Good point. Tom?
That may be true in Eden, but I doubt that that's true elsewhere.
Yeah.
That would have been true for me in Colorado Springs. I owned there, and I sold and basically broke even. But had I rented, and looking back, I wish I had rented in Colorado Springs. The cost of living is about double there. I still would have been ahead.
You know, it's supply and demand. It's not true in Dallas.
Yeah.
That's just incredible. That gave us half when we first moved in. I don't know how we got through the curve. Every year we were there, we've been in a two-bedroom house for $175. Lady that owned it said she paid the pledge tax. If she was a believer, she paid the pledge tax. She charged the tax. She knew we were moving in starter. You can't go out and find that
tax. Yeah. Let's go ahead on. Yes, we do want people to say. We do want people to sleep at night. Okay, what I'd like you to do is turn in your handout, if you would, to the pink pages. Let's talk about the debt trap for just a minute. Let's talk about what happens, the compounding effect of interest, the finance companies load up interest. Let's take an example here and work through it together. You can give me some of the answers. Let's see. We're going to assume that we're going to go into debt and find out what it costs us. And our example says that we're going to go into debt $1,000 a year. The interest on it is going to cost us 18%, and we don't have the money to pay the interest, so we're going to borrow the interest and see what that does to us, and we're going to have to do this before for 5 years before we get out of it. Now, what are the results? What happens to us? What's the total debt that's accumulated after 5 years of borrowing and compounded interest? $8,442. At the end of the first 5 years, your total debt is $8,442. You see it there? $1,000 each year. The first year interest accumulates $180. The total debt is $1,180. Year two, you borrow another $1,000. Interest is on the $2,000 you borrowed, plus you've had to borrow the $180. So now the new total of debt's up to $2,572. And so on, it accumulated up to $8,442. Now, to pay off the debt, a couple things have to happen. You got to take, unless you've been fortunate to get an increase in income, if that hasn't happened, now to pay off $8,442, you're going to have to suffer a decrease in your real spending ability. Not only are you going to have to cut your spending by the $1,000 a month, the $1,000 a year that you were borrowing, but now you're going to have to decrease it even more than that to pay back the debt. So, our principal, in order to pay back $8,442, again, let's assume 5 years, we're going to have to make annual payments of principal and interest of what? That's right, $2,573. Look at what's happened to your decrease in your disposable income. You not only cut it $1,000, but you've had to cut it $2,573. Let's look at the total cost. Years 1 through 5, the interest cost on the $5,000 for year 1 through 5 was what?
$2,442.
Cost you $3,442 for years 1 through 5. What about years 6 through 10, the repayment period?
$4,423.
And what is the total interest cost? Cost you $7,865 to borrow $5,000. Folks, that is called working for your money. That's called being enslaved for your money. Let's talk about saving. Well, let's back up just a second. How are we going to get out of debt? Let me give you two ways of getting out of debt, and they're both in the yellow sheets.
The red.
I'm sorry. That's the pink. I said yellow. How do you get out of debt? Well, two things. First of all, we've talked about should be on the back of the pink sheet there,
page 11,
how to get out of debt. Two concepts up there at the top. One is to find out where you're at. It's to prepare a financial statement on you to determine whether you have equity or whether you have a net debt. And the second, we're going to look at that in just a second. And the second is to sell highly depreciating things. And we've talked about the cars. What I'd suggest that you do is, if you have highly depreciating items that you borrowed money on, you go through this list very carefully and evaluate on that particular item, whether it's a boat or a trailer or something like that. One, does it increase my effectiveness in serving God? Yes or no? Evaluate that for yourself. Deal honestly. Is it absolutely essential? Again, if it is, check it. If it's not, check that. And could it be replaced by a less expensive item? Skip down one. Its value is not increasing, or it is. Go through the list, then add up the number of checks on the right and on the left, and look at it. Be honest with yourself. Be objective about whether or not, from your own evaluation, that particular item needs to be gotten rid of. Now, that's one way. Secondly, is to sit down and evaluate your personal financial situation. It's what we call preparing a financial statement, a financial summary. I've given you an example of it right here. It's called a financial summary here on pages 9 and 10. Page 9 is listing your assets. Now let me caution you on when you develop a financial summary for yourself. By the way, you should do this just for your own managing of the assets that you got, so you know where you're at. When you prepare this financial analysis, you need to put down what the value is in today's market, not what you paid for the thing. A house today, if it were in Oklahoma, is 20% less than it was in 1980. So you put down what the value of the home is today, not what you paid for it. Stocks and bonds, if you are in a mutual fund or investments in stocks, put down what the stock exchange is reporting as the value of the asset, not what you paid for it. Personal effects, your automobile, get the blue book out, find out what the value of it is. Yes, John?
Up there on the assets, you show IRAs and savings and investments.
I would put under three savings. My company has a 401k matching program where the company puts in money. I list because I'm vested 100%, I put what the company's put in and I put what I've put in because it's all my money now. I'm fully vested. So yeah, I list that up there. List the realizable value out of it. So if you weren't 100% invested, don't list the whole thing because it's not all yours to take. So once you've listed your assets down there, total them up at the bottom. On page 10, list your debts, the mortgage on your home. If most of you, I would assume that most, if not everyone here who has a house, has an amortizing mortgage so that the principal goes down, you know, a few pennies a month. Find out where you're at on the amortization schedule and put your actual debt. Put your credit cards, and I made a note on mine, even the unused credit. If you have a couple credit cards, where you're really at is not what you have on your charge card, it's what's the potential for being on there. So if you have a $2,500 limit, put that on.
Why would you do that? I mean, just because you got a piece of paper in your pocket that might have a $5,000 limit,
Well, the reason why I would suggest you put it down there is because any credit company that's going to evaluate your net worth is going to evaluate the potential for you to be in debt. And an unused credit card represents the potential for you to be in debt. That's why I, you know, in mine, I would put down what the maximum is. As a liability.
It's like when you buy build a house, you borrow $100,000. That is your debt. You may not have all used that up yet in the construction of that house, but that debt is still assigned to you 100%.
But you have borrowed the money for that. If you are using a credit card, you have not impounded that money. If you borrowed $100,000 to get a house,
you haven't borrowed the money, but you have incurred the debt. The debt was incurred the day you signed on that charge card slip and signed your name and said if you borrowed any money up to, if that limit is $2,500, you agreed to pay for that. If you feel more comfortable putting down your balance, put down your balance. Any company that evaluates your credit is going to look at the total you could be in debt.
Doesn't seem right to me, though.
So, what it simply means they're not going to go find out on what you got on it. They're going to say,
that's right,
what's your limit, and assume you've got it all there. They're not going to look and find out what your balance is.
Right.
That's proprietary information. They're going to assume the limit.
It's probably 89% of the cases there.
That's why they do it.
Yes, there's a question over here.
If you have a Like, I have a credit card, and I pay off the full every month, and they raise my limit 1 month to $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
I pay the pay it every month in full, mm-hmm. and then just, you know, a couple months ago, they raise it up to $3,000. I mean, do I have any say so against it?
Yeah, you can call them and tell them,
you know, take it down to whatever.
Yeah. If you don't need that much credit, don't have them, don't let them increase your credit line.
Okay, yeah, because they send you money.
Right. Okay, let's go on. I understand there might be some disagreement about it, but let's move on. If you have any business debts, you may have borrowed some money for... you may have borrowed some money for a business venture, put down what you borrowed. If the business asset that you borrowed has gone down, the debt still remains. It's a liability you own. School loans, there are other things there, as you can see. List, total up your debt, subtract it from your assets, and in accounting terms, assets minus liabilities equals hopefully a positive number. If it's a negative number, you need to increase your earnings potential, sell some of your assets, pay down some of your debts. Okay. Let's talk about saving now. We've talked about debt. Debt is negative savings. Let's talk about savings now. Turn to the green sheet in there, page 18. We're going to save $1,000 a year, and we're going to earn interest at a lesser amount, which is, if you can get a 12% compounding investment, that's a pre-tax investment, you ought to leap on that, because those just aren't available. 12% interest for 5 years. Okay. Everybody with me? We're going to save $1,000 a month. Work through these with me. Okay, that gives us a total of $1,000. And what's the interest earnings off that $1,000 the first year? $120. Okay, that gives us a balance of $1,120, even my simplistic adding can get that. Okay, year two, we add another $1,000. I'm not going to copy those down. What's the total? Well, here it is $2,000. That's what we've invested, and the interest earnings that year, what?
$254.
Total?
20%. This is something that puts $1,000 down on January 1.
That's right, at the beginning of the year.
But it's not including paying it into a savings program throughout the year.
No, this is just very simplistic. Yeah, we could do compounded. It is a compounded interest calculation, but it's not a monthly payment. In the fifth year, we have put in our final $1,000 at the beginning of the year. We've saved a total of $5,000. What's the cumulative interest?
$762.
Okay, that's the interest that year. And then the total balance? Okay, $7,114. For a $5,000 investment, you receive back $7,114. That is making your money work for you. That is making your money work for you. Some of the best kinds of investments you can make if you work for a company that's got a tax-deferred savings plan. They call them by various names. 125, Section 125 is a plan, 401k, those are savings plan. That's a savings plan that allow you to do it out of pre-tax money. Does everybody understand the concept of those 401k plans? You're allowed to save the money before the income tax is taken, and you don't pay the tax until the day you take the money out. IRAs are another way to do that, as long as you're not in a qualified pension plan. After 20 years of this kind of saving, you will have accumulated $72,000. $72,052. And fella, that is letting your money work for you as opposed to going into debt. I want to shift I would be glad to talk to you more afterwards about the savings, but I want to talk about budgeting. It's my own personal experience and observation that very few people actually budget because they don't know what a budget is. They don't know how to develop a budget. What is a budget? Let me throw that out to you. Some of your ideas. What is a budget? It's a plan. Okay? What else? What is a budget?
It's got limits.
Okay, a budget has limits. What else? Come on. More ideas. What's a budget?
Goals.
Okay.
Something the government does with that.
Something incapable of developing, much less. Okay?
Spending and play the credit. Is it complete? It encompasses everything?
Yeah, it encompasses everything. It's a plan. Is it a plan by itself? Is that what a budget is? Just a plan?
So one of action.
It involves action. A budget involves performance, complying to the plan. And then what, as a final step?
Measuring
and evaluating. That's what a budget is. It is preparing in advance what you're going to earn and what you're going to spend. Then it is the monitoring of that as you go through the month and the evaluation of that at the end of the month. We have a horse farm, an Arabian horse farm. Those folks have been losing money like it's just going out of style, at least $500,000 a year, which is incomprehensible when I look at my own budget. She can lose that and more. But the critical problem is we try to develop a plan. There is no measurement during the period, and there's no evaluation at the end. So it's not a budget. Let's talk about how you make a budget. Find out where your money goes monthly. That's the most important thing. That's the beginning of developing a budget, is determining what you do with what you spend. That means that you've got to take your checkbook and you've got to log it in and you've got to make a sheet of paper and describe what you're spending so you can evaluate it. Secondly, it's plan your spending, which involves thinking. It involves making choices of choosing this and not choosing that. And the final thing is balancing your budget, is looking at it at the end. I've got an example budget I want you guys to help me with. Person one and person two, and then you and me. Let's go through it together. Person number one has a monthly budget. They have an income of $1,000 a month and simplified expenses. They owe $100 on income tax. This person saves $50. They don't give anything. They have a home mortgage they have to pay for. They got groceries. They have a budget for recreation, and then they've got some credit cards they have to pay off. And this person has monthly expenses of $1,150. And what's this person's problem? Why don't you give me some? Okay, and where at, Drew?
Looks like a credit card.
They got a real credit card problem. Okay, is that their only problem?
No giving, no saving.
No giving, no saving, no margin. No ability to have temporary downturns. In fact, this person's going to have to go to the bank and have somebody loan him some money just to get into the next month. Right? This person has an unsatisfactory budget. Let's take person number two.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us, this is a budget that a lot of us, probably some of us in this room, are living. And we look at the numbers and we think it's absurd, but there are fellas here that this is the budget, folks. This is the budget. Mine. To do with what I want. Isn't that what the world tells us? You hear these credit card commercials on the TV, MasterCard, Visa, Sears, all these Discover cards, so you get money back. There's a myth out there that your money is yours to do with what you want. It belongs to you. You deserve it. You earn it. You get it. That, you know, it's yours, Toyota. What's the second myth? What's the second myth? The second myth from the world's perspective.
Money is evil.
Huh?
Money is evil.
Well,
are you on page one or two?
Yeah.
Let's see. Let me see your hand in a second.
Are you in the right class?
Am I in the right class? Am I in the right class? Yes, I'm in the right class. Well, I've worded these just a little bit different than Kirk has them worded. Money is evil. You can write these things in your notes. Let me give them to you the way I present them.
We'll ask the question.
You ask the question. Debt's okay. That's another worldview of money. Debt is okay. It's okay to borrow money. It's okay to go to bankruptcy, right? I mean, those are common things that all of us hear about today. There's really no shame in it. There's no, the society has pulled the stigmas out. Debt's okay. After all, the federal government does it. And if they can go in X trillions of dollars in debt, certainly you and I on our MasterCard can do it. The third world viewpoint is that financial pressure is an inescapable fact of life. Financial pressure is an inescapable fact of life. You can't do anything about it. In fact, you just need to adjust your living standards and accept it as the pressures that are unavoidable. There's some biblical viewpoints of money, though, that are counter to the world. The first one is all that I have belongs to God. All that I have belongs to God. All of the money I have, all of the resources I have, the talents I have, the abilities I have, all that belongs to God. That's a biblical viewpoint. 1 Corinthians 7:23 in the Living Bible says, you have been bought with a price for Christ, so you belong to Him. Be free from all these earthly prides and fears. You and me belong to God. Second biblical perspective on money is that debt is the same as slavery. Proverbs, book in the Bible, chapter 22, verse 7 says, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave of the lender. Debt equals slavery. The Bible doesn't say that it's wrong to be in debt. It just says it's a financially unwise thing to do. It's a financially unsound thing to do. I know that getting out of debt is not an easy thing to do. Paying off your credit cards is not an easy thing to do. And some of the concepts we're going to talk about this morning are not going to be particularly easy. I understand that. I was a person who borrowed money to buy a car. I had to liquidate the car. I had to sell the car to resolve that problem, to get out of debt. I understand what that means. I drove a 1979 Buick for about 10 years. I still have it, trying to sell it. It's not easy to get out of debt, but it is the godly thing to do. Philippians 4:13 does say, I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. You and I can get financially free. We can get out from under those pressures. Thirdly, that financial pressure is not an inescapable fact of life. Thirdly, financial pressure is not an inescapable fact of life. In fact, in Psalms 37, verse 4 and 5, the Bible says, but delight yourself, be delighted with the Lord. He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit everything you do to the Lord. Trust Him to help you, and He will do it. The Bible says that God will provide for our need. It also says in Romans 12, verse 2, does someone have that memorized? Romans 12, 2. Okay, whoa. God isn't the spirit of confusion. Let's see. David?
You're not conforming in all your pattern of this world, you'll be transformed by the renewing of your mind, and you'll be able to test and prove what God's will is.
Yeah.
It's good and perfect.
Yeah. The key, don't be conformed to the world. The world's pattern is this, God's pattern is that. He says, don't become conformed conformity is it's like molding plastic into an image. It's a slow process that takes time, but the end result is the formed thing looks like the form. And God says, don't let yourselves be formed to the world. If you're going to avoid the marketing techniques of the banks, of the insurance industries, and other kinds of institutions that are selling their product to you, and they've made financially it attractive for you to get those. I saw, this week on television, I think it's Ford Motor Company is now trying to sell apparently some excess cars. I think it's their Escorts for 1.9% financing. They're trying to do whatever they can do to hook you, to get you trapped into the system that will mold you. And if you buy a car for 1.9% financing, when you're done with that car, you're just as likely to go out there and buy a car at regular financing because they have started to train your pattern of thought. They are training you to think like they want you to think, and God has a different plan. In Luke 16, 1 through 13, it's a parable of the unrighteous steward. I just want to recount some of the stories there, give you some of the thoughts. You remember that it was the story about a man. He was a steward. He was a financial manager for his master. He was going to be laid off, and so prior to the layoff, he went out and he transacted some business with some associates, some debtors that owed his master some money, and he traded off those debts at a discount. And so Jesus Christ complimented him for acting shrewdly, acted as a shrewd manager. Now, Jesus wasn't complimenting the man's particular behavior. What he was doing was complimenting the steward's management of money. He managed the money correctly for the owner. So that's one. A steward is required to be faithful in the managing of his resources. Money is one of them. Secondly, that passage of Scripture tells us that you cannot love God and money at the same time. You can't affix your affections on the dollar and earning an income and at the same time set your heart on God. They're mutually exclusive, and money will take you away from God. And in the business that I'm in, I am constantly associated with people who have financial means, and I see the things that they think about. I see the things that they do with their time, and they are incapable of knowing God because their hearts and desires are on money and on wealth. And what are they going to do with the next car that they have? And it's a cycle. Rockefeller made a quote. In fact, someone asked him, how many millions would it take to make him happy? And he said, just one more. That's just like us. He's just describing our life. One more million. One, if I can just get the next car, if I can just get the next better paying job. And we live and we long and we set our minds for the next, whatever it is. And fellas, God wants us to focus our attention on today and the present. Not that we shouldn't plan. We're going to talk about planning and investing and saving in a minute, but God wants us to focus on Him rather than money. We're going to talk about four aspects of money this morning. Earning an income, giving, saving, and spending. And I would like you to feel free, as you already have, to stop me and let's discuss some of these things. Okay? I don't want to just bypass them too quickly. Earning, giving, saving, and spending. Let's start off by talking about earning an income. Earning an income. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 22 in the Living says, "So I saw that there is nothing better than for men that they should be happy in their work." That's a tremendous That's a tremendous verse. I don't know how you feel about your job, but I know for me, I get a lot of personal self-satisfaction for doing the work that I'm doing. I happen to be just thrilled with my job. I get up in the morning. I go to work. I enjoy it. I'm dealing with the numbers, bean counter mentality. I wake up in the morning thinking about the next piece of real estate I want to buy or sell. I love it. In fact, I have to daily commit what I'm doing to the Lord so that I can focus on Him. And Ecclesiastes says it's good for a man to love his work. It's good for a man. It's healthy for a man.
Is that 322?
322.
Oh, pardon me?
Okay. Secondly, I must have gotten these out of order. Secondly, these are just some of my own thoughts, again, on earning an income. Be happy with your work. Secondly, be a man of integrity. Be a man of honesty. 1 Thessalonians 4:11 and 12 says, and again, these are quotes from the Living Bible, this should be your ambition, to live a quiet life, minding your own business, doing your own work, just as we told you before. As a result, people who are not Christians will trust and respect you, and you will not need to depend on others for enough money to pay your bills. Be a man of integrity, someone that in your company people single out is a man that's totally trustworthy. And that, this, guys, begins in the little things. Begins in the little things, not taking books, paper clips, pens home. I'm notorious about having to keep myself a vigilance on this, of looking in my briefcase to make sure I'm not taking anything away from the company, that everything that's theirs stays with them. Be a man of integrity. People will respect it. You will earn their respect. Thirdly, avoid get-rich-quick schemes. Part of my job is to review financial opportunities for the wealthy fellow that owns our company. I review all of his investments, and there's a truckload of things out there that are not worth a minute's worth of your time on. And if you don't have the expertise to evaluate them, if you can't look at the numbers, then don't believe them. There are things out there that you can lose your money on, and most of us need to be more concerned about preserving our capital than trying to make a quick buck on something. Some rules of thumb that I go by is if you can't understand it quickly, don't get involved in it. Things that are overly complicated are prime candidates for financial destruction for you. If you don't have, again, I think I may have mentioned this, if you don't have the expertise, find somebody that you respect that understands financial numbers and get their opinion on it. And probably most importantly is ask them to see a track record. Ask them to produce for you the results that they have done on other similar investments so you can see if they know what they're doing. Oil and gas is a good example of high-risk investments. Now, in our company, we invest in oil and gas, but we look at it very closely. We've developed some expertise in it. Novices need to be careful. It's a good way to lose what you have. Never risk money that you cannot afford to lose. Never risk money that you cannot afford to lose. There are a host of people, I don't know if maybe you've received some of these telephone calls, come down to our vacation spot down in the southwest part of the state, look at this piece of real estate, and then we'll give you either your choice of a boat, TV, or an RV. And you get down there and you find it's an inflatable raft and it wasn't worth the time to even pay attention. Those kinds of investment opportunities are high pressure sales gimmicks that rarely have rarely can meet the expectation that those people purport to meet. And there, avoid those folks. I hope there's nobody in here that sells that kind of stuff. I personally would like to single you out. My secretary did that, and she went down and bought a piece of property. She'll probably never be able to get rid of it, and she got a rubber raft in exchange for it.
Why didn't she take the DVD?
Well, you get one of the three. You know, it's the lucky number, and she turned up the boat. So just what kind of boat it was that she didn't know. The fourth thing is... Fourth thing here on the list is the working wife. I understand, I don't know, and I don't want to know here how many of your wives work. My wife worked at one time before we had children. I'm going to speak to you about personal conviction and not necessarily about hard and fast rules, but personally, as I see kids growing up today in the tragedy of being institutionalized because mom is trying to support the second income in the family, and so the kid is checked in at 6 o'clock in the morning and picked up at 5 o'clock at night, and the parents are both too tired to pay any attention to the child, and we are raising up a generation, fellas, of institutionalized kids that have no sense of morals, that have no sense of who God is, and we are trading that for money. And I understand the difficulty of living on a one-income family. We do it. We don't drive new cars. We bought a smaller house than what we would have liked. We have styled and condensed our standard of living to accommodate one standard of living. And I don't throw stones at people that their wives have to work. My secretary, her husband is... He's an invalid. He was involved in an automobile accident and permanently impaired. He can't work, so she is forced to work. I don't throw stones at those people. Those folks are the exception to the rules. Most of us, the sole motivation to put our wives out there is the next dollar so that we can drive two cars, have a big house, summer house in the country, and that sort of thing. You know, there are all kinds of ways to evaluate that. I dare you to look at the child care costs, the income tax brackets, what you do with your money, the emotional energy you have left over. All those are reasons, guys. All of those are reasons. Those are common sense things for not getting involved in having your wife work. I want to digress here for a minute, and I want to talk about credit cards. Credit cards. The quickest way to get into debt and not even realize it's happened to you. I would guess conservatively that every person in this room has a credit card.
Wrong.
Good. Well, there's a couple then.
What's your definition of a credit card?
Credit card is could be a gasoline credit card. It could be a Sears Discover card, a Visa, a MasterCard, those kinds of plastic cards that just facilitate instantaneous purchases. That's a credit card. Now, before you execute me, let me give you my points on it. You may be a person that can handle a credit card, but folks, for the vast majority of people, their credit cards are written up, are charged up to the limit, and people out there, associates of yours at work, are surviving, barely able to make their credit card payment, the minimum payments. I think we have a credit card. It's a USAA MasterCard, and I think it has a minimum payment of something like $10 a month. And so these kids, you know, we endeavor every single month to pay that thing off. There's never a carryover balance. But there are folks out there in my office. I work with an office of about 75 women, girls that range from, I'd say, maybe 20 to 35, you know, about 75 of them. And and the stories about how they barely make it. It's a real problem. Let me give you some warnings, six of them. I got six points in five lines here. I did this earlier this morning. I guess I should have slept in. 6 points. And I hope this is in your notes. Plan before you make purchases. You know, if you pray before you make an expenditure, or you sit down with your sweetheart, if you have a sweetheart, or your dog, if you have a dog, or whatever it is that you talk to, and your fish, and talk about whether you need that. Talk about it. How does it fit in with what you're trying to do, other things you have? You'll be surprised if you take a limited amount of time and just talk about that purchase. You will... You might decide not to make it. You'll think it through. You might be inclined to postpone the purchase. Think about it. Pray about it. Ask God if He wants you to have it. Secondly, avoid spontaneous purchases. Avoid spontaneous purchases. Spontaneous purchases when you're going. My wife absolutely refuses to take me window shopping because I am the perfect victim for people in the malls. We go to shopping and, you know, they push the tennis shoe rack right out into the middle of the aisle and you see it and they got the little things on it, you know, and I fall victim to that. So, you know, we try not to go window shopping. That's our solution to avoiding the trap of spontaneous purchases. Thirdly, be able to pay your charge cards off when the bills come due. Pay your charge cards off monthly. That discipline will help you to think before you buy something with plastic, because you're going to be thinking about whether you're able to pay that balance off. Make it a rule in your family, make it a law. We won't charge anything that we can't pay for. Fourth thing is limit the number of cards. I don't know whether you have had this experience, but once you start charging things on a charge card, all of a sudden, Tom, Dick, and Harry, XYZ company, get your name, and all of a sudden you start getting pre-approved 2,500 limit charge cards. I mean, they start appearing in the mail. This bank, this clearinghouse, that company, all of a sudden everybody has you on a mailing list, and you've got these throw those things in the trash can when they come in. Don't even be tempted to send the card in, thinking in your mind, well, I'll put the card in the desk, and I'll just leave it there in case I need it. You don't need that. God has already said He's going to provide for your need. That's a temptation, fellows, that most of us don't need to endure through.
How do we get your names?
Well, a lot of times there's a mailing that a service, most of the MasterCard Visa bills are run through clearinghouses. It's not actually the bank that manages it. It's a clearinghouse that manages it. The bank fronts for the business, and those people develop name lists and address. And what they do is, a bank in Oklahoma City may want to open up a charge card business. They'll write to this clearinghouse. They'll ask them to give them all the zip codes that fall from 74102 to 83276. And then they get this list. And lo and behold, there you are on the list. And you don't even know it. And so you're targeted as a customer. That's how they get them. It's done all the time. Most mass mailings are done that way.
Is it possible to review the fine print very carefully and compare the annual charges and interest rates from the ones that come out and then make a decision as maybe cut up the one you're using and go with someone else?
Absolutely. That is a good point. I appreciate you bringing that up. Interest rates range from 12 or 14% to as much as 21%. Some of these cards carry a $45 or $50 annual charge for them. And I don't care what Discover says about giving you 1% of your sales back, they're going to charge you the highest interest rate almost of anybody in town. How do you think they cover that? They get it back through victims that leave balances on. That's a good point. I appreciate you bringing that up. Be selective. That's right. Those people make their money by you leaving balances on your cards. That's the pure fact of that. It is a marketing gimmick. Yes, Tom?
Debit credit cards.
That's almost a contradiction. Think like an ATM card.
Oh, well, I have one. I use it. But I also go home and log those things directly into my checkbook right when I do it. My wife put me on a lunch budget. I know I got $10 a week to spend. It's kind of meager, but we got an ATM machine. I go get my $10 on Monday, and I make sure I use the machine that they don't deduct me 50 cents for the use of the card. Again, that's a cost of using those cards. People. Yes, John?
I'll just add one thing on paying off monthly. I use credit cards, but I have the money in the bank when I make the purchase. Not 30 days from now, but I already have the money. Because if I spend money I don't have, I'm going in debt, and I've made a promise not to go in debt in that way.
It's a good point, John. Excellent point. Yeah, Dave?
This is something I learned, and I don't know if that's been verified, but if you purchase an item with a credit card, it will make the warranty twice as long. Is there any truth to that?
There are some credit cards. I think it's specific to the credit card. I don't really know. I can't speak to that. I will tell you that if someone does a consumer check on your credit rating, then I'll get to you in just a second. If someone does a consumer check on your credit rating, you go down to that bureau that gives you those credit ratings. Every charge card that you've got the maximum limit is a debit against your account. In other words, if you've got five cards out there and each one of them has $1,000, then it's going to show whether you have a zero balance or a positive balance, it's going to show you having $5,000 worth of debt out there. May not be important to you, but it's you need to know it yet.
People do have credit card debts that they're trying to pay off at a high interest rate. There's credit cards that you can get from banks in Arkansas that have much lower interest. 13-14%
are quite a bit cheaper than those credit cards, because I think Arkansas is a state law that they can't charge more than a certain amount. I found that if you absolutely have to have a credit card, there are some credit cards that are sort of like a debit card. It's you have to have a cash balance in an account, and all you do is draw that down, and you pay it back up at the end of the month. And that's probably the best way to get out of the credit card trap, if you want to do that.
Not have to carry cash.
Yeah.
Right. You know, if you want to rent a car somewhere, no one's going to take your check in Washington, D.C. to rent a car.
Yeah.
And if you have a quote credit card that has a $5,000 balance in the bank and you're just drawing it down rather than filling it up, that's not even a credit card.
Yeah.
It's a bank card.
Yeah, I'm not even really familiar with that. There's a fellow in the back that's been
trying. I have a question. I have a question for you. There's nothing that I could afford more. But every once in a while, I have some things that I'd like to have in my flashlight. So I have applied, and actually, I received a credit card with no intention. I cut it out as soon as I received it. And my doubt came to my mind. What about the record that I made if I
Well, most of those credit card companies, if you haven't used the balance, they notify you that your card's been terminated.
And what kind of record is that?
Well, as long as the credit card is issued to you, then as far as those agencies that report credit ratings, you've got a whatever the maximum limit on that credit card is, showing as a debt, whether you have anything on it or not. Yeah, Tom?
And I agree with everything you're saying about credit cards, but there are sometimes, for example, if you decide you want to buy a house, I know you're going to get to the mortgages at some point, But if you don't have any credit history, zero, it's really tough to try to get any kind of loan.
Yeah, there's ways of establishing credit in town that doesn't necessitate a credit card. For example, go down to, we have a company in Oklahoma called Big O Tires. You go down there and they will let you pay 2-3 months on a pair of tires, you know, and that's their way of selling tires. You've established credit. There is creative ways of doing it, Tom. Again, I'm not trying to argue people shouldn't have credit cards. I'm just trying to say let's come up with some ground rules so we manage our money the way the Lord would like it. But yeah, that's a good point.
Using credit cards, and I've heard that objection or that I treat it sort of as an excuse for having a credit card so that I can establish credit. One of my best friends is my banker. He was my friend before he was my banker. But he's told me several times that if you know how good it makes me feel to have somebody come in here and sit down and ask me how do you advise me to establish a credit rating. And my wife and I did this last year. We were married with a banker out in East Texas. And she said, look, you've got money in the bank. Just come in here and let me write you a loan. We can put the interest down as low as you want. Because that's the purpose. Is not to not to charge you a lot of interest, but to establish a record. And we bought things we needed, like a washing machine. We could have charged them a ticket, but we'd have paid more interest on it. But all we were doing was just laying down a paper trail of a record of credit. And that has stood up. That's helped. That's served the purpose of a credit, establishing a credit. And yet we didn't even cost us hardly anything.
Yeah.
Okay. We could have paid them off when we took them out, but we just did it to go through the motions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's a good use of it. One more question, then we're going to move on.
Why do we need a credit rating?
Why do you
need a loan
or a car?
I don't know any banker that won't loan you money based on never having borrowed money. My wife and I have never borrowed money in our life. We went out and I was making 26 or 27,000 a year. Bought a $60,000 house. We've never borrowed any money in our life. Banker jumped at the chance. To this day, we still never borrowed money on a car, pay our credit cards off immediately, and up until 4 years ago, I never owned a credit card and only bought one because I found that I couldn't rent a car with that one. But I think that's a lie that Satan uses, is this deal of you got to establish credit. In fact, I even question my motivation as to buying a house on credit as to whether or not that is of God. Because there's a verse in Proverbs that says, do not be one who puts up security for debts, lest your very debt would be snatched from under you. Well, you know, my debt is in my house. And here I'm thinking that my house is the only thing I should borrow money on. That is, you know, that verse even makes me question whether I should borrow money on a house.
Yeah. Well, most people wouldn't argue with you.